Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 4th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as we'll be discussing the net neutrality case argued just this morning in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to proceed a little bit differently today. I'm going to turn things over to Adam White in just a moment, and they'll have some back-and-forth exchanges, our two experts will. But as is typical, we'll get to audience questions sometime in the near future here, so please do be thinking about your questions in advance. We're going to hear first from Adam J. White. He's a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. And we'll hear then from E. Brantley Webb. She's an associate at Mayor Brown right here in Washington, D.C. They both were able to attend oral argument, and they're going to give us some background on the case and then discuss what happened at oral argument and maybe some implications going forward. With that, Mr. Adam White, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. This morning, the D.C. Circuit heard oral arguments in a closely watched case on the FCC's power to regulate broadband internet, including its net neutrality policy. When I say they heard oral arguments, I mean they heard a lot of oral arguments. It went on for, I think, about 3 hours, from about 9:30 to 12:30. The case proceeded in four stages. And like I said, went on for 3 hours, the variety of advocates. It really is the latest stage in a decade or more of policy dialogue at the FCC, before that at Congress, proceeding repeatedly to the D.C. Circuit, and now for one more trip up to the court. The case was heard by three judges, Judge David Tatel, Judge Srinivasan, and Senior Judge Williams. In fact, there were so many people in attendance that the case filled the ceremonial courtroom on the top floor of the court, and then I believe two spillover courtrooms. Now, there were a lot of issues in play today. Like I said, the case proceeded in four stages. And Brantley and I are going to try to take a similar approach to recapping the issues and offering some recapping of what happened at oral argument. And so I'll turn it over to Brantley to begin by giving an account of the history of the regulatory framework at issue, and then we'll just dive into the issues before the court. So, Brantley?
Great. Thanks, Adam. So this case has a very, very long history that sort of goes all the way back, just to give a very general overview, all the way back to the 1930s and even before. The FCC has a long history of regulating what's generally referred to as sort of electronic communications media in the United States, beginning with telegraph and radio and moving on to broadcast and cable television. Through this history, the FCC came up with sort of two different categories of communication services and regulated each differently. One was basic services that have sort of pure transmission capability, and the second was enhanced services, which the FCC defined as providing computer processing capabilities, the ability to store information. In 1996, Congress codified this distinction in the Telecommunications Act and redefined these terms as telecommunications service with pure transmission capability and information service, which involves the more enhanced computer processing services. The FCC thereafter held that the provision of internet access service is an information service. It applied this definition more recently to cable broadband, and in an important 2005 decision called Brand X, the Supreme Court upheld that definition. Sometime thereafter, the FCC began to think about how to impose sort of the net neutrality values and sort of requirements on the internet, and it has adopted, as Adam alluded to, a number of different approaches, which have been largely rejected by the courts thus far. It adopted the first order and rules seeking to preserve sort of open internet in December 2010. And in that order, it relied on Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act, which essentially encourages the deployment on a reasonable and timely basis of advanced telecommunications capability to all Americans. Now, the D.C. Circuit, in considering that, held that that section of the Act does not give the FCC the power to essentially impose traditional common carrier type regulations on Internet service providers, such as anti-blocking rules or anti-discrimination rules, which leads us to this order. In this order, the FCC, wanting to impose those sorts of traditional common carrier rules, reclassified the provision of Internet access provision as a telecommunications service under Title II of the Act. And then I don't know if you have anything else before we get into the issues in the case. That's sort of a general background that led up to today's argument.
Right.
Okay, great. So the first portion of the argument today, which took the longest, was argument about the FCC's decision to reclassify the provision of Internet service to a telecommunications service. The petitioners, the main petitioners in the case, U.S. Telecom, represented by Peter Keisler, essentially argued that the FCC does not have the power that it claims to have here, which is the authority to reclassify. Essentially, he said that the statute, you know, creates the telecommunications statute of 1996, adopting those prior definitions that the FCC had formulated, creates two categories of service. And petitioners argued that at its heart, the provision of Internet service is an information service. It has, you know, data processing elements, storage, caching elements, and they emphasized strongly that actual web access itself is an information service. I would say that at the outset, Judge Srinivasan was actually interested in sort of going back to the provision of older sort of traditional telecommunication services like just simple phone service and thinking about whether elements of the provision of phone service actually involved, you know, information service-like components such as the directory listing of numbers, things like that. So he focused on that a little bit. Judge Tatel was interested in the Brand X decision and, you know, asked the petitioners whether, you know, Brand X, in fact, gave the FCC discretion to choose to put the provision of Internet service into either telecommunications or information service. The petitioners were pretty adamant that there's no ambiguity that Internet service at least involves some component of that core information service processing. The government got up and sort of emphasized that Brand X, in fact, gave them the discretion to choose, and that they essentially looked at the facts on the ground and concluded, you know, as they've explained in the briefs, that broadband service in large part moves information without any change to that information, and that any sort of information processing is sort of incidental to that core transmission service or can be characterized as sort of general management of a network. The judges sort of pressed the government on the reason for their sort of drastic change in rationale and noted that the facts on the ground had not actually changed. So, you know, how could they change their approach so dramatically? And the government's answer essentially was that, you know, the FCC really focused on what it considered to be the biggest threats to free and open Internet, and that it concluded, you know, newly that common carriage regulation was necessary to prevent those serious threats. Judge Williams was particularly interested in the paid prioritization, and I think as Adam's going to talk a little bit more about. He asked the government essentially whether or not the record actually showed that paid prioritization would result in any disadvantage to consumers. He compared it to some of the, he has a very deep sort of knowledge of traditional common carrier regulation, compared this to some of the railway regulations, and compared sort of a fast lane on the internet for Netflix to a refrigerated car on a train. You pay a little bit more because it's necessary for you to do so. And he sort of pressed the government on this, and he also pressed them on whether there were other sort of regulatory toolkits to address these perceived threats to the internet, including the antitrust laws. Adam, I don't know if you have anything you want to add on that.
Just a little bit. And I'll say, I ought to say up front, I'm not exactly a neutral observer in this case. I was, at the time of the filing of the briefs, I was counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates, where we represented Tech Freedom and a number of entrepreneurs from a group called the Tech Elders, a Silicon Valley-based circle of tech entrepreneurs. We filed briefs in support of the petitioners challenging the FCC's case, the FCC's rule, and I remain of counsel to the firm and the parties in this case. I agree with what Brantley said, and I just to add a couple of points. One is that in this first segment of the argument on the reclassification of broadband, it was very interesting to watch the petitioners and the government and their basic narrative of the arguments. The petitioners, represented by Peter Keisler, in a remarkably good oral argument today, I've got to say, he really tried to bring things back to statutory text and the instructions that Congress had given, especially in the 1996 Act, in which Congress, in its findings in Section 230 of the Communications Act now, said it is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services unfettered by federal or state regulation. He returned to that kind of statutory text time and again to create this basic baseline of Congress's policy on broadband internet just 20 years ago and going forward, namely this light touch regulatory approach that was basically the opposite of heavy-handed common carrier regulation. Meanwhile, the government's approach, as it is often in many complex regulatory cases, sorts of cases in which courts traditionally give a significant amount of deference to the agency, both in its statutory interpretations and in its predictive and technical judgments, the FCC's approach was in large part to construe the statutory text as broadly as possible, to paint the facts on the ground as being extremely technically complex and open to subjective judgments by the agency, and then to ask largely for the court's deference in interpreting either the laws or the facts going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how the judges ultimately come down, whether they're more inclined to side with the petitioner's sort of conception of the case or the respondent's. Now, among the judges, and all three of them were very interesting to have on this panel, just in brief, Judge Tatel, he heard the last and I think wrote the majority opinion in the last big net neutrality case called Verizon v. FCC. Judge Srinivasan is one of the newest members of the court and well-respected here in Washington, and a lot of people were interested in what his view of the case would be. But Judge Williams, I think, was a particularly interesting draw for this case. He's been on the D.C. Circuit for a very long time, but before that, he was an energy law professor out at Colorado, and published a lot on energy regulation and regulated industries more generally. And he's sort of known around the court as one of the few, maybe the only judge in the court that actually likes FERC energy cases. But that really, that background really shined through at oral argument today, whereas Brantley indicated, Judge Williams tried to bring a lot of this back to first principles of what's called common carrier regulation. You know, traditionally, railroads or telephone lines or pipelines, these basic natural monopolies that are sort of the core of public utility regulation. And Judge Williams seemed particularly interested in a few ways in which the FCC's approach seemed to depart from the basics of common carrier regulation. You know, the one that Brantley already alluded to is that even with common carrier regulation, it doesn't mean that a railroad or a pipeline has to treat all of its customers completely equally. If there's one customer that wants to pay more for sort of premium service, it's usually allowed, the pipeline or the railroad is usually allowed to do so. In this case, though, that's precisely the sort of thing that the FCC has categorically barred with what is called paid prioritization, namely the ability of a broadband internet service to accept sort of premium payments to prioritize certain transmissions, whether it's paying extra for high-quality video or voice-over internet, which is a technology that my clients in this case, many of them had been involved in. Those are the sorts of things that might seem to pass muster under traditional common carrier regulation, but are for some reason categorically barred here. And Judge Williams really sort of poked around on that, trying to understand why the FCC took this particular approach, its own sort of departure from traditional common carrier regulation. A few other interesting things that Judge Williams said at oral argument. He seemed particularly interested in comments filed in the rulemaking by former FCC chief economists, comments for which he thought the FCC just simply didn't offer a strong enough or any response. If I understood him correctly, he noted at one point that the FCC was in this case asking for the court's deference to the agency's predictive judgments about the future of broadband internet, while at the same time the FCC was itself breaking pretty sharply from the FCC's own past judgments through all of these changes in policy and statutory interpretation. I think that was one of his questions near the end of the FCC's opening presentation. I thought it was a very interesting one. So I think I'll leave it at that. Brantley, do you have anything else on the main broadband reclassification?
No, I think that covers it. You know, there are a lot of issues, and we'd be happy to go into more detail on any particular issue that any of the listeners have. But I think the next portion of the argument was mobile broadband access, and I think Adam's going to speak a little bit about that.
Sure. The second part of the case, like Brantley said, is about not landline, your sort of traditional broadband internet, but mobile broadband service, say the type of broadband internet you might get through your smartphone. As the petitioners argued in this case, even after you reclassify broadband internet service as a Title II common carrier service by the FCC, the FCC needs to jump through a couple more hoops before it can extend the same common carrier treatment to mobile broadband. Mobile phone service, you know, is treated the same as your landline phone in terms of dialing phone numbers, but mobile services that are not interconnected with the telephone network are not treated the same way. And this is what I mean. To apply common carrier treatment to a service, the FCC can make something a common carrier service only if it's what's called commercial mobile service. And I apologize in advance for how technical this is going to get. And if I botch anything, I'm sure Bethany will correct me. But commercial mobile service, a common carrier, is the service that's provided for profit and makes provided to customers for profit and makes what's called an interconnected service available to the public. An interconnected service under the Act is, quote, a service that is interconnected with the public switched network. That's the key term, the public switched network. Traditionally, as I understand it, the public switched network has always meant the telephone system. The numbers you dial from your home phone or your cell phone or 1,000 years ago, a payphone. In this case, the FCC, recognizing that mobile broadband doesn't itself tie directly into the phone number system, the FCC reinterpreted the term public switched network to include both the network of telephone numbers and the network of IP addresses, the special numbers that are used to locate computers on the internet. Now, this seemed problematic because it was a break from past practice, including, according to petitioners, past FCC practice that Congress effectively incorporated into its definitions in the 1996 Act, spelling out these limitations on the ability of the FCC to regulate mobile services as a common carrier. Now, the FCC, they insist that their new interpretation of public switch network covering both telephone numbers and IP addresses is perfectly reasonable under the statute and that the agency deserves deference. The FCC's fallback position is that even if the so-called public switched network is just phone numbers, mobile services, mobile broadband, is still sufficiently interconnected with the network, since if you have a smartphone with an app that allows you to make voice over internet calls, internet-based phone calls that aren't tied to a phone number, you can interconnect with the network, you can call phone numbers, and that, the FCC argues, is sufficient to tie mobile broadband into the broader public switch networks. The petitioner's main response, as I understand it, was that this isn't enough of an interconnection, that the networks between your computer network for mobile broadband and the phone network, they don't themselves interconnect. It's only when users have an app, say Vonage or something, that allows them to reach out to traditional telephone numbers, are the networks, do they interact with one another. Judge Tatel seemed interested in this argument. There was, for a long time at oral argument, he kept talking about his phone, actually his personal phone, in terms of not being, put it this way, a phone that only makes phone calls, that's not used to surf the internet. He later pointed out he actually does have a smartphone. He sort of wanted to dispel the implication he's using an old flip phone. But he said, you know, on my phone, I make calls, but I can't call an IP address. I can only call phone numbers. So how is my phone interconnected with the traditional public switched network? So he pressed on that at length. It was very interesting. The FCC's final fallback position is that even if mobile broadband isn't part of the public switch network, and even if it's not sufficiently interconnected with the public switch network, it's still functionally equivalent to commercial mobile service because it's widely available and it allows its users to communicate with a vast majority of the public. The petitioners argued basically that these justifications were arbitrary and capricious. The petitioners didn't just challenge the substance of the FCC's interpretations on mobile broadband, though. They also argued, they made the procedural arguments that the petitioners, the industry, had received no notice from the FCC in the notice of proposed rulemaking that these legal interpretations were really subject to change. They said they had basically no clue from the notice of proposed rulemaking that these reinterpretations were possible. They followed a lot of comments and analysis on other aspects of mobile broadband, but in terms of these legal reinterpretations that I just spelled out, they said that they had no notice at all, and therefore, even on just strictly procedural grounds, the reclassification of mobile broadband should be thrown out. Now, on these last points, on the mobile broadband issues, the judges were interested in the notice issues, it seemed. They were interested in the ways in which the FCC was breaking from its past statutory and regulatory interpretations. On the substantive points, as I mentioned, Judge Tatel was particularly active, and I have to admit, as I sat there in the audience listening to his questions, it called to mind a speech that he gave in 2009 that I'd encourage listeners to check out. It was published in the Harvard Environmental Law Review in 2010. It was called The Administrative Process and the Rule of Environmental Law, and just pardon the brief digression, but in 2009 he gave a speech on the standards of administrative law that would be governing the EPA's decisions going forward. This was at an environmental law event. But a lot of his points that he made there seemed straight out of the questions that he asked today and vice versa. He argued against agencies choosing policy first and then later seeking to defend legality. He said, and I'll bring up the key quotes, he urged that courts take special notice when agencies are changing existing policy, as happens quite often during times of transition. Again, this is a speech in 2009. He warned the agency that agencies must expressly address contrary evidence and significant alternatives. He said, quote, "We need to keep agencies tethered to Congress and to our representative system of government." And ultimately, he said, "The constitutional values that animate our core principles of administrative law require agencies to consider the legality of their policies from the very beginning of the administrative process." And almost maybe seemingly ironically, he said at the time, indeed, Julius Jenkowski, the new chair of the Federal Communications Commission, recently told me that he's working to do exactly that at his agency. So the issues before him, especially on mobile broadband, but also in traditional broadband reclassification, issues of notice, issues of departure from past precedent, issues of responding to comments filed that are contrary to challenging the agency's analysis, and the agency's sort of clear tethering of itself to the statutory mandate, the statutory terms that Congress has set, however broad they might be, those are the sorts of issues that he was really pressing at oral argument today. And so, again, I encourage people to look up this 2010 article and review it for themselves. Brantley, do you have anything else to add on the mobile broadband issues?
No, I guess we're running up against our time here, so maybe we should cover the First Amendment and then take some questions.
Sure. Real briefly, the next and sort of last major issue in the case on those trying to strike down the FCC's rulemaking were First Amendment issues. These were brought by Alamo Broadband and Daniel Berninger, a couple of petitioners. They argued, citing the precedent involving cable television and traditional publications like the newspapers and newsprint, that broadband internet service providers are speakers, communicators, just as newspapers and cable television providers are. They argue that, as such, the transmissions by the broadband companies are covered by the First Amendment speech and press protections. They argue that the FCC's limitations on the broadband providers' ability to decide what to transmit and what not to transmit was subject to strict scrutiny review. And they argued that the FCC's rules in this case failed to satisfy even intermittent scrutiny. This was the last argument, and there were a few questions from the judges and from, obviously, the FCC rejected all of this. There were questions about whether common carriers have lesser First Amendment rights. There were questions about whether internet service providers really are curating content the way that, say, a cable provider is in selecting which channels to broadcast. It'll be interesting to see where the judges come down on this, but especially in the rebuttal, I found the FCC's arguments had led it to an interesting place. The FCC's position is that broadband providers are still fully allowed to decide not to transmit certain materials. Say you could create maybe a family-friendly version of broadband internet that screens out objectionable content. The providers, they argued, are still perfectly allowed to do this. They just are no longer treated as broadband internet for the purposes of the rules. It's interesting, and also the government argued the broadband service providers are. It's one thing for them to say we don't want to transmit content based on moral considerations, say objectionable content, but in this case they argued to the extent that broadband providers want to do this, it's strictly for monetary reasons, for marketing reasons, and not for any kind of moral reasons. And I was left thinking this: the FCC sets up sort of an interesting dichotomy. They say they make it basically an all or nothing choice. You either, a broadband internet service provider either transmits content or blocks a website, but they can't say prioritize or deprioritize certain content by making it sort of more quickly accessible on the internet. And similarly, the FCC says you can only do it for moral reasons and not for strictly monetary reasons, which seems like a false dichotomy because you might well do it for both. It'll be interesting to see whether the court ultimately needs to reach the constitutional issues precisely because there were questions about the substance of the rulemaking itself. If the court strikes down the rulemaking, it won't need to reach the First Amendment issues. But it'll be interesting to see if the court reaches that issue, precisely how they analogize broadband internet providers to cable, to newsprint, or to something altogether different. Brantley, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one sort of interesting thing that came up in that portion of the argument at the very end, where the petitioner got up and said that, you know, essentially, although the FCC may try to argue here that, you know, the First Amendment doesn't apply to these internet, these broadband internet providers. In fact, the reason we're here today is because these broadband providers do have the power to editorialize. And so in some, you know, in some ways, you know, judges, you can't avoid this question. So the sort of different positions in the case do present, I think, some complicated issues for the court when it's trying to sort of resolve what to address when.
Now, at the very end of the case, there was one last set of petitioners, namely petitioners who challenged the FCC not for regulating too much, but rather for regulating too little. They argued that the FCC acted unlawfully when, in its rulemaking, it coupled this new regulatory framework with a broad grant of what's called forbearance, namely the FCC saying, we're going to regulate it, but we're going to stay our hand with respect to a lot of the ways in which we could further regulate broadband internet. These petitioners, they're led by a company called Full Service Network, argue that the FCC acted unlawfully and arbitrarily by not following through with the full suite of regulations, especially when those regulations, they argued, Congress created that type of regulation to protect consumers, particular communities, and others who will receive insufficient protection under the FCC's rulemaking. Now, like I said, it was a long day of oral argument. It was 3 hours covering an immense waterfront of issues. Brantley and I, and I'm sure everybody else in attendance, are still digesting them. There will be, if I may say, there will be an event next week on Tuesday, December 8th at 10 a.m., involving a number of the parties, lawyers, and actually Brantley as well. It's hosted by my clients in the case, Tech Freedom. And so if you go to techfreedom.org, you'll find all the information and where to RSVP. The event's going to be moderated by the FCC Wireless Bureau Chief, the former FCC Wireless Bureau Chief, Michelle Farquhar. So I encourage everybody to check that out. Dean, do you want to open this up to questions?
Yeah, let's do that. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make our typical announcement about upcoming Teleforum calls. I think tomorrow we're turning our attention to the Supreme Court and what might be the biggest term, the biggest week of the term, at least so far. Monday we'll do a preview of the Evenwell case. That's the one-person, one-vote Supreme Court case being argued Tuesday. So on Tuesday we'll talk again about Evenwell, but from the perspective of having heard the argument. Later in the week we'll be covering the Fisher affirmative action case and the Harris redistricting case. Of course, today we're talking about a case in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on net neutrality. We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Evan. I just from Tech Freedom. I've just been getting the sense from people who were present at the arguments that that the FCC had a really hard time on interconnection and reclassifying mobile broadband, and that they had a better time dealing with the Chevron stuff as it relates to Brand X. I just wanted to kind of get a sense from Adam and Brantley if you got the same impression that the FCC did poorly on those two but did a better job on the Chevron stuff.
Well, I would just say, Evan, first of all, as any lawyer would add the usual boilerplate, oral argument questions are always a very unreliable barometer of where the judges are at the moment and where they'll ultimately be. So, you know, hesitate to read too much into particular questions. I think it is fair to say, though, and Brantley may disagree, that the judges seemed pretty energized on the mobile broadband questioning. There seemed a bit more, it might just be only a function of the fact that there were just so many extra hoops that the FCC has to jump through to reclassify mobile internet. And so there was many more opportunities for reverses of old positions, judgment calls open to question, and so on. But yeah, I do think the judges, you hate to sort of say they're more interested in one issue or the other, but I'd say they are very strongly interested in the mobile broadband. Chevron deference, you know, and I'll be quite frank, the brief that I filed with my colleagues on behalf of Tech Freedom and the tech elders, we focused a lot on Chevron deference in the brief, and quite frankly, there wasn't as much discussion of Chevron per se at the oral argument as I might have hoped or expected. There was definitely a lot of claims by the FCC for deference, but it's not clear, it wasn't clear to me exactly how the court is going to walk through and apply Chevron deference on particular issues. It'll be interesting to see. Brantley?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think one sort of common thread in both the interconnection issue and the mobile broadband issue was that that the court sort of raised, I think, questions about was the notice that was given by the FCC to the participants in the notice and comment process. Both issues, the notice was a bit lighter from the FCC. The petitioners argued that, you know, in one instance there was sort of only one sentence hinting at it, and there had been some statements to the contrary that for interconnection issues it would have been a separate rulemaking. And so they made very strong arguments that with respect to both of those issues, they didn't have the proper notice to actually address the issues before the agency. And so I think that was the sort of thread through both of those issues that raised some, that I guess the judges had some questions about.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. This is Dean. Before we move on to the next caller, let me ask a follow-up, if I could, on the deference question. Does this rule qualify as a major question, quote unquote, that Justice Roberts referred to in the Affordable Care Act case, the notion that courts won't defer to agencies under certain circumstances, especially if they're particularly momentous? I think in oral argument they talked about billions and billions of dollars at stake. It strikes me that this might be that sort of circumstance.
Well, quite frankly, Dean, I hope you're right, because that was the thrust of our brief for Tech Freedom. Was one of the main arguments was the deference issue in King and in Utility Air Regulatory Group, and one of those issues being the major questions doctrine. I'd hate to say otherwise, but quite honestly, they didn't really focus explicitly on that aspect of the Chevron deference issue. Now, when they get to oral argument, if they do decide to apply Chevron deference, no matter whether they are going to ultimately come down on the side of the FCC or the challengers, if they do decide to go that route and apply Chevron deference, they will have to make what's called the Chevron Step Zero inquiry of whether Chevron deference applies at all. And like you said, Chief Justice Roberts, his opinion for the court in King v. Burwell, you know, will require the court, the D.C. Circuit, to consider whether this is a sufficiently major question. Judge Tatel, in his previous case, Verizon versus FCC, did touch on a little bit, a fair amount actually, of the Brown and Williamson major questions doctrine. That predated King v. Burwell, and we're very interested to see how he ultimately walks through that issue post King v. Burwell.
Was there, if I could ask, Adam, was there a brief on the other side arguing that the rule here did not rise to the level of a major question?
There were so many briefs filed in the case that if I say that there wasn't a brief that touched on this, I probably just overlooked it. But I'll be honest, and again, I'm not an unbiased observer here. This was our part of the case. The FCC itself really didn't grapple with those issues that we'd teed up, and we didn't, in our survey of the amicus briefs, didn't see any others that really dove into this. The FCC and others seemed to sort of take for granted that Chevron would apply in its ordinary course and that the agency should get the traditional amount of deference owed to it with an allegedly ambiguous statutory text.
Fair enough. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, we've got just one caller question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button
than the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, this is Victoria Sutton, professor of law at Texas Tech University. And I have a question. It's a broader question here about why this case exists in the first place. And in the Native American community, it was recognized that one tribe could bring a case that would have a negative impact on everybody permanently. And so tribes decided to get together to create a better picture of a litigation strategy. Now, tribes aren't constrained by antitrust, but I'm just wondering, given the fact that a lot of people perceive Verizon's persistence of pushback leading to this regulation, was there any attempt or is there any forward thinking about maybe the telecommunications industry thinking about what kind of litigation strategy they should or should not be pursuing to make a better environment, work environment and business environment and better environment for the public?
Who wants to take a shot at that one? Adam or Brantley, any response there?
Brantley, you have any thoughts on that? I honestly, I'm not quite sure where to start with it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess not being privy to the sort of internal decision-making process within the industry, I think it's always, you know, hard for a large sort of unwieldy industry to come up with a, you know, a coherent process like the one that you're describing. You know, and I do know that the petitioners in the case cited a number of times at oral argument the problem with just being sort of totally surprised by what the FCC did, you know, sort of at the last minute. So I think that unpredictability at the agency level, you know, also, you know, makes it tricky, I think, to come up with sort of a long-term plan for, you know, because I take it what you're envisioning is sort of not just coordinating with the same position, but also trying to sort of figure out where you'd like the, you know, the regulation to go and how it should interact with your own, you know, practices as a company. And I think if you do have, you know, as the petitioners argue, some real sort of unpredictability issues at the agency level, it is harder to forecast, you know, where the regulations are going to go. And at least that's what the petitioners in this case, you know, are arguing has sort of happened. You know, prior to this order, they didn't, you know, they didn't think that, or there wasn't a lot of indication that the FCC would reclassify the entire, you know, broadband service as, you know, common carriage under Title II. They were sort of anticipating what had been indicated before, that it would be, you know, regulated with openness and transparency requirements, things like that under Section 706.
You know, and now you've said that, I guess I would like to add one further point. It's, and I think you can see this not just in the context of the open internet order, the net neutrality rule. You see it in other big regulatory issues right now. I think in the EPA's Clean Power Plan, the big suite of greenhouse gas regulations. You see it in the debates over the immigration policy and others, where there are statutes that were passed a fair amount of time ago, a long time ago sometimes, without an eye, obviously, to current circumstances, whether it's a, you know, a 1934 Communications Act that couldn't have envisioned modern internet, or even a 96 Act that for which, you know, the current internet seemed pretty far in the future, whether it's the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, decades after the Clean Air Act is passed, or whether it's immigration laws that haven't been updated from 86. When these laws are passed a long time ago in a different context and they're written in broad terms, it really creates a challenge both for the regulators and also for the regulated community with what the regulators would argue is either less guidance from Congress or more open-ended guidance from Congress. It seems easier for the agency to claim or to think it's entitled to sort of broader leeway in applying the law. And again, this is one of the points that Tatel really gets at in that 2009 speech. The problem, and this was on display at the argument today, is that with a traditional legislative process followed by sort of an open and transparent regulatory process with a real fulsome and thorough notice of proposed rulemaking and then comments and a final rule is that the public kind of sees what's in play and is able to react, to comment, and to calibrate expectations accordingly. I think it might be fair to say that the most emphatic theme that came from the judges today, at least among the themes cutting against the FCC, is that the notice on this rulemaking, especially with respect to mobile broadband, was really seems paltry now and non-existent. The FCC would point to individual statutory references and say, we cited this statute and it shows that statutory interpretation was in play. The judges struck me as dissatisfied with that justification and really dissatisfied with the amount of transparency in the process that involved not just the FCC, but a groundswell of public opinion and then the president's own comments towards the FCC. That was really sort of what seems to be sorely lacking in this case, and I think it undermines both the substance, the substance of the ultimate rulemaking product, and also the public's ability to sort of see what's coming next.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button while we're waiting to see if anyone else rings in. Let me ask a follow-up question sort of on the interaction between the deference, judicial deference, and then this, I don't know if you'd call it irregularity, or I don't want to characterize how you would characterize the notice and comment period such as it was, but is there anything in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence or in the D.C. Circuit that would indicate a court should give less deference to an agency when it doesn't engage in appropriate notice and comment? Now, I mean, not to the extent that it would violate the APA and be thrown out on those grounds alone, but how do those two things interact, if at all?
Apparently, I could take that unless you have thoughts that you want to throw in there right away.
Well,
like you said, the first thing you'd look at is the procedural protections of the APA, but even just setting that aside and thinking just about the Chevron analysis, there's a lot of law professors will say there's a fair amount of overlap between notions of arbitrary and capriciousness under the APA and with Chevron step two, the question of whether an interpretation of an ambiguous statute is reasonable. And so it may be true that sort of a dissatisfactory process by the agency might leave judges less confident in the reasonableness of its ultimate interpretation. But I think really up front, the real keys are whether the agency checked all the procedural boxes, whether it responded to comments, and whether it made a rational connection between the facts it found and the policy and interpretations it ultimately endorsed. But even just in Chevron step two, if you're trying to decide whether or not an interpretation of a statute is reasonable, it's almost inevitable that you're going to have at least an eye to the reasoning process itself.
It looks like we don't have a final question, so maybe that's going to be our final question. Let me give each of you a chance to give a final thought here. As you do so, I'm curious if you have any. I wouldn't necessarily ask you for predictions in terms of outcome, but what about the timing? Is there any sense or track record here on the D.C. Circuit Court's time frame for turning a case like this around? And as you address that, if you'd give any final thoughts you'd like to give. And why don't we start with you, if we could, Brantley?
Sure. I think it's very hard to predict the timing of the opinion, but one thing to guide any prediction would be the enormous complexity of the case and also just how extremely engaged, each of the three judges were today at oral argument with, Judge Williams, as we alluded to, really focusing on some of the history of common carrier regulation. Judge Srinivasan, very interested in sort of the technology comparisons between traditional telecommunications services and internet provision. And Judge Tatel, very interested in, I think, how the how the deference questions will work and how the Supreme Court's opinion in Brandeis should be interpreted. So all of them, will have a lot to say, I think. So, and there are so many sort of different discrete issues, some of which we haven't even covered today, in the case, and so many stakeholders. I think it's, you know, it will be a long and sort of comprehensive opinion.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think, as Brantley indicated, there's going to be opportunities, not just the need to wade through thick issues, but also opportunities for judges to disagree with each other, either on small points or on the big picture or on the path forward. If there's one thing that Judge Tatel especially, but all the judges, is aware of now, is that this series of cases keeps building upon itself, and that no matter what they do, they're going to need to sort of point a path to the road ahead one way or the other. And so I think this one's going to take time, at least into late spring and quite possibly into the summer. Now, if you're interested, if you're not into Christmas songs at this time of year and you're looking for a three-hour oral argument to listen to, the audio is already available on the D.C. Circuit's website. It's downloadable in two parts. So that's up. The court itself doesn't publish a transcript, but sometimes parties do, so keep an eye out for that. Otherwise, I'd encourage you to go to Brantley's event next week over at Tech Freedom it's on techfreedom.org, the website, to get the views of a broader spectrum of observers and participants after a little bit more time to digest all of this.
Well, let me thank you both for enduring a three-hour argument and then taking time this afternoon to join us and give us a presentation and then answer questions. Thank you to Brantley Webb and to Adam White. We certainly appreciate your insights in this complicated matter, and we'd love to have you back when an opinion emerges, just to get your thoughts on what it means going forward. I want to thank the audience as well for joining the call, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be previewing the Evenwell One Person, One Vote oral argument that's happening on Tuesday. But that call, again, is Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.